I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Black Panther, the movie, is heading toward $1 billion at the box office on just its third weekend. And already it seems that commercial success is likely not what Black Panther will be remembered for. It is a grand coming together of African-American cultural production. The story in it is a mix of myth and magic in the made-up African nation of Wakanda. It is a technologically advanced society in a land that never got colonized, and it holds the world's only big deposits of an all-powerful mineral element, vibranium. Think brains and vibrations. With its vibranium, Wakanda could, if it chose, take over the planet. So Wakanda is a showcase of black agency, and so is this movie Black Panther, in all of the arts, writers, actors, working off fact and fantasy, imagination and history, and tough-minded politics too. The talent ranges across the board. Set and sound designers, composers in many modes, musicians by the score, geniuses in costume and makeup, but also computer graphics, stuntmen, and of course stunt women as well. The closing credits run forever, as they must. In the stunned aftermath of watching it, not least of the marvels about this movie is realizing that Black Panther, the character, and a lot of his immense fan base is built on the culture of comic books that lots of us have never read. So this hour's inventory of Black Panther first impressions starts with those drawings, going back even before the Marvel Comics series that began in the 1960s. John Jennings leads the way. Prolific in comic books and illustrated novels like Octavia Butler's Kindred, for example, John Jennings grew up drawing in Mississippi. He's professor of media studies now at the University of California, Riverside. In conversation this week, John Jennings said, "This story is not about the numbers.
This film hasn't even opened in Japan or China yet. So, yeah, there's no way it doesn't make a billion, maybe almost $1.5 billion worldwide."
I'd love you to take us into the world, the politics of it, the art of it, in a sense, the musical, the cosmology, the religion.
Afro-Americans in this country have been thinking about the future or about speculation around race and identity since the beginning. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote science fiction stories, right?
Didn't know that.
He has a whole collection of them. To me, the first Afrofuturist, or a collection of Afrofuturists, I think, were the first slaves who said, you know what, let's get the heck up out of here. You know, seriously, let's. Well, the thing about the Great Migration, you know, Chicago was Wakanda to people from the South. You know, I'm from Mississippi originally. And so imagine trying to put yourself into a better space where you're free, where you actually have agency, where your kids can grow up safe and healthy. That was Chicago and other places from the South where, you know, black people were met with nothing but turmoil and, you know, slavery and pain, you know. So, you know, Afrofuturism to me gives us a space to kind of posit, okay, well, what if these particular types of disruptive colonial issues didn't happen, like a Wakanda, right? Or can we imagine a better space? I mean, if you look at, like, for instance, music, right? Sun Ra, the experimental jazz musician, you know, he posits, yes, well, if we can't have freedom on this particular planet, maybe space is the place, right? That's why it's called, you know, space is the place. I was like, okay, well, let's think about places where we actually can be free. Because as you know, I mean, you know, race and space are highly conflated, right? The black body becomes the index for bad spaces, you know, the hood, across the tracks, you know, these types of notions, sketchy neighborhoods, right? The dark continent, you know, that kind of thing. So all these different things are connected to the physical manifestation of race, right?
I love it. So the artist challenge is to sketch me an alternative space. Sketch me out of this sketchy place.
Right, exactly. So you look at, like, a space like Wakanda that was, you know, created by these two white Jewish men in 1966, who I'm sure were probably, like, inundated with, like, the politics of the time, right? And also, you know, we're talking about Sun Ra being in the same city at the same time, too. He's actually generating, you know, all this funky music and things of that nature, that, you know, experimental jazz. And, you know, Jack Kirby was very much in the know as far as, like, you know, pop art and all these different types of movements. And then, of course, you go down south and Stokely Carmichael utters, you know, we need black power in Mississippi, of all places, in Greenville, Mississippi, the same year. And then you look on television, 1966, you have Uhuru, you know, the first, like, really major black space character, right? So all these things are happening at the same time. And even though the Black Panther Party doesn't take its name from the comic book, you know, it's interesting that, you know, these notions are created at the same time.
John, you're describing an alternative medium a parallel universe that a lot of us don't know. How does it connect with, say, civil rights politics since the 60s, or jazz, or hip-hop, for that matter?
Oh, it connects quite a bit. Isn't it interesting that this element that they covet so much is essentially an index for sound? It's called vibranium, right? So what it does is that it collects and redistributes sound. So think about what that means as far as, like, it's an index for oral culture and music and hip hop and jet as an element, right? Of course, the sister movement to the Black power struggle was also the Black arts movement, right?
Yes.
I think that what I've posited fairly recently is what I call the Black speculative arts movement. So what I've seen is a resurgence of, like, Black art that is of a speculative nature, say fantasy, horror, science fiction, what have you, that it's actually, like, fused with these anti-prison industrial complex movements, you know, the movements around Black lives in America. Yeah. I think because you see, like, people who are actually on the streets protesting who are making science fiction and fantasy stories. So, for instance, if you look at, like, books like Octavia's Brood, right, where you actually have, like, a collection of on-the-ground activists who are writing science fiction about better spaces. Or there was this one that came out of Baltimore. I can't remember the name of it right now, that actually was positing a future Baltimore. So this idea of, like, you know, using this West African notion of nomo, that, you know, speaking things into existence and writing yourself into the future. This is what Octavia Butler talks about, too, in her work. So I think definitely it's all connected, you know.
Who are the real idea mongers, major players in this world?
There's a ton of, like, scholars who are working in this area. We just did a symposium called Planet Deep South. We created this thing called Planet Deep South a few years ago. Well, it was kind of looking at the fact that a lot of these Afrofuturist writers and scholars were coming out of the South. So, you know, Sun Ra was from the South.
Right.
You know, Henry Dumas was from the South. Zora Neale Hurston. And even if you look at someone like Dr. King or Medgar Evers, these are people who are dreaming of better futures. They're all Southern political leaders. William Johnson was from Jackson, Mississippi. Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire. Even George Clinton down South. All these people from the South. You know, and so they're trying to think about, okay, well, I've come up in this particular space. Like, how do I move forward with this? Now, if you look at, like, people from the Black arts movement, like, say, Amiri Baraka, Henry Dumas, people like Toni Morrison, they're actually writing science fiction and speculative stories to talk about Black politics. Henry Dumas in particular was writing. A lot of people don't know him because he was killed, like, at 33 by a cop in Harlem. But he was really good friends with Sun Ra. He was actually coming from a Sun Ra concert, a practice in Harlem. And most of his work was about critiquing society through speculative fiction. But, you know, I think that the rise of these particular characters has always been about the people underneath, like, actually pushing these things, you know. So, you know, this culture has been here for a long time. It's like, if you go to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in the middle of Harlem, on the day of the Black Comic Book Festival, which is the Friday and Saturday before MLK Day, people wrapped around the building, waiting to get in to see not Black Panther or, like, you know, Black Iron Man or the Falcon or whatever. They are there to see Black independent comic book artists. And everyone there sells out. And so we're talking about a space where literally the ashes of Langston Hughes are buried in the foundation of this place. It's like peak Blackness. It's on MLK weekend. It's Malcolm X Boulevard, middle of Harlem, all Black everything, you know. And it's Wakanda for those 2 days.
Wow. I'm going to see you there next year, John.
Yes, you should. Oh, my God, you're going to love it. Seriously, like, it's a celebration of creativity. And these are all Black independent comic book artists that we focus on in our book, Black Comics Returns, right? And so we have entrepreneurs who are of color, who are from various backgrounds, who are making comics day in and day out. We have people who, like, and one of my friends is a bouncer. His name is Chuck Collins. He's a bouncer by night. He goes home and makes comic books. You see what I'm saying? We have people who are waitresses and doctors and lawyers who have the talent to make comics, and they go home and they make comic books. We have designers who design something for, like, you know, a medical pharmaceutical company all day, and they go home and make comic books. This is what I'm talking about, you know, who have this particular type of zeal and talent to actually go and have the skill sets to make these things, you know.
What are the big ideas about humanity that animate this world?
See, this notion of, like, the Black body being safe in America has not really been the case. Black people in America, you know, were directly connected to three different spaces, and that was the slave ship, plantation, and the grave. Those are the only three spaces we were supposed to be connected to.
Wow.
So we were fungible objects that became people after the Emancipation Proclamation. Let's be real about it. So Wakanda, this Black speculative arts movement space, even the black towns that we were forced to create in the 1920s and was subsequently destroyed, you know, like Black Wall Street, familiar with Black Wall Street, right? Mm. 1921 Tulsa, Oklahoma riot, where, like, you know, the first time that a town was bombed from the sky was a black town with had 6 millionaires in it.
G-Town.
That was Wakanda. You know, Rosewood was Wakanda. And so, you know, what happens when these particular types of things happen? You know, that's what, just be free to be a kid and not get shot for playing with a play gun, or to go to the grocery store and not get killed for being a thug. You know, that would be nice to have. And these are things that people take for granted if you haven't been treated in this fashion. So, you know, white people and black people are constructed. These are not real things. You know, they're not real. You know, there's no such thing. But there is a real thing. And so, you know, so it's this weird conundrum around how race is constructed. I was not born black. I was socialized to be black because of the surroundings around me, you know, because of race and class and all these different things. So to be actually be free to kind of drop these things would be nice in an Afro future where these things don't matter. But until then, I think we just have to create these stories as ways to resist these skin cells, as I call them, right? Because that's what they are. I mean, we're just trapped in these little bodies, right? And then we make stories about them. And that's what it is. I mean, race is just a story.
Is there a Afrofuturism outside the American world, even in Africa itself?
Yes. And that's what we're watching. As a next step is, you know, people from those spaces creating their own stories. So, for instance, there's a group of artists in the Black Comics Returns book that are out of Barbados that are making comic books. Kenya, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Jamaica. That's exciting. You know, they have people like Mary Cahillo, who's making film. There's some things come out of Nollywood, you know, the Nigerian film industry. It's a very exciting time, you know, and I don't see it like receding this time. I see it actually because, like, we've been doing this work like 10 years, you know, before Black Panther even broke wide. And it's incredible. And I think people are seeing themselves in these spaces and pushing it forward and say, hey, you know what? These stories matter. And, you know, we have the means to get them out.
John Jennings dedicated his new anthology titled Black Comics Returns to all the little black boys and girls who never have to know what it's like not to see yourself as a hero, a subject, as vital to the society you live in. Coming up, the deep distinguished past and the varieties today of Afrofuturism. This is Open Source. Black Panther, in the line of pop superhero flicks that now pay Hollywood's bills, is also a compendium of nuanced cultural and political themes. Our guest, Harvey Young, is the new dean of the College of Fine Arts at Boston University. What do you make of it, Harvey? Where do you want to begin, including just the theater of it? You've written a lot about theater, including your book about Chicago, Black Theater is Black Life. Where do you put Black Panther?
I have to say, I love the concept of peak blackness. That
John Jennings, isn't that amazing?
That was absolutely extraordinary. And in watching the movie, I think there was a point midway through in which I felt that sense of peakness and saturation, and it was actually extraordinary. For me as a theater person, what I find really worth considering is how the current narrative going into the movie is that it's really about these two male protagonists. But what I found extraordinary was how it's really about the women in that film. They are strong, they're independent, they have self-confidence, they have a level of multidimensionality that you don't see on stage or on film, from Angela Bassett as the mother to Lupita Nyong'o as a kind of a soldier, eventual love interest.
Yep.
Is extraordinary.
And Letitia Wright as Shuri, the sort of, some say, the moral center of the picture.
Oh, absolutely.
Nakia.
I love the fact that she is inspiring a whole bunch of people, parents, kids, to be a role model for the next Disney princess, for example. Extraordinary. Also, when you think about this film, often within film culture, you have the black sidekick, a person mm-hmm. who's on stage for just a few moments. But here, you essentially have the white sidekick with Martin Freeman from the Avengers
movie. I still wonder what he was doing there, the CIA guy back from the old days or something.
Yeah, it's just a character there that who appears, or even Andy Serkis, who plays the bad guy, you know, at the beginning, and you think that he's going to be the key villain, the key antagonist, but he disappears pretty early in the film to make room for Killmonger.
A couple of other things from John Jennings. Does everybody have or need a Wakanda in their head, in their heart somewhere?
I think everyone hopes there's a Wakanda. I think everyone would like for there to at some point be a Wakanda in the future.
There's another line of his that I just love. Now, what was it? But the whole notion of a surge internationally, Ethiopia, Nigeria, everybody in the black world working on this kind of project in their heads or otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. And when you talk to, or rather you read interviews with the cast, they talk about walking into the set and looking around and seeing for the first time in their lives people who look like themselves as crew, as cast members, working catering, working everywhere. And that's extraordinary.
Stand by, Harvey Young. Yatasha Womack joins us from Chicago. She's a dancer, filmmaker, futurist. She describes herself as champion of humanity and imagination. She wrote the book on Afrofuturism, subtitled The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. It tracks the cultural aesthetic that links T'Challa, king of Wakanda, to the great jazz experimentalist Sun Ra and his famous orchestra. Yatasha, walk us through this sci-fi, as it's called, sci-fi with a happy ending, Afrofuturism, the range of it.
Well, Afrofuturism is a way of looking at the future or alternate realities, but it's through a black cultural lens. And when I say black cultural lens, I mean the African continent and the African diaspora. It is a intersection between black culture, the imagination, liberation, technology, and also mysticism. Hmm. So you'll see it as an artistic aesthetic, but it's also a way of looking at the world and, for many people, a tool for self-healing.
Describe this mysticism. It's not churchy. Is it contra-churchy?
Well, it's more or less that it's counter-churchy. I think it's about it being a recognition of a oneness with the universe. So for some people, that means a connection to African traditional religions or African-derived religions, native religions. And in other cases, it expresses itself through metaphysics or other forms of spirituality, too. But I think what bridges it all together is this understanding that you are a citizen of the earth, you're a citizen of this planet, but a person in a larger universe and wanting to establish some connection with that.
It sounds like what little I know of voodoo and ancestor worship.
Well, you know, in a lot of traditional, a lot of African and African-derived approaches to spirituality, there's a recognition of ancestors and there's a recognition of the people who are to come, right? There's this continuum.
Right.
And in Afrofuturism, you know, one of the exciting things that makes it a little different from other takes on futurism and sci-fi is that there's an active relationship between the future, the past, and the present, which reflects these African traditional approaches towards time.
You feel that strongly, if I may say, in the movie. It's about the future. It's about making plans, but also behaving today as if it will be important in the long run. Harvey, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Let's go to other voices we heard this week testifying to the intensity of this new preoccupation called Black Panther watching. Brooke Obi in New York grew up on U.S. Air Force bases. She's a recovering lawyer now, full-time novelist and writer. She's seen Black Panther 5 times so far. In her review of the movie for the black cinema site Shadow and Act, she puts forward a strong defense of Eric Killmonger and the lost children of Wakanda.
It's an amazing film that really deals with this issue of calling to account how we leave oppressed people behind. And that's why Eric Killmonger as a character was so compelling for me. And I started to think really deeply about what director Ryan Coogler wanted us to get from his story.
Brooke Obi, you say, you know, Killmonger could have been the real hero. He is the not only revolutionary, but an avenger for Black Africa. The movie ends with T'Challa on the throne. He'd rather reach out to the world, be an example to the world. but preserve the perfect sovereignty of Wakanda. Score this contest as you see it.
I don't think that this movie has a hero. I think that is what makes Black Panther one of the most compelling superhero movies to ever exist. I do not believe that T'Challa is a hero. I don't believe that Killmonger is the hero, but I'm not quick to ascribe him the label of villain. The issue, you know, with Killmonger is he's aware, like his father, N'Jobu, he's aware that there are Black people who look like him all around the world who are struggling. And that that is not okay. And that it is totally systemic. And that, you know, these systems of oppression exist and are crippling Black people simply because of our race around the world. T'Challa does not recognize anybody outside of Wakanda as his people. And that's something that Killmonger calls him on, is that, you know, Africa is the heart of civilization. So aren't all people your people? But, you know, to T'Challa, if you're not Wakandan, you're not his people. But there is one, Nakia, who is Wakandan, who is, you know, the kind of love interest of T'Challa, who has told him that there are people suffering outside of Wakanda and we need to use our resources to help them. She has the best approach. Her approach is a lot more feminist. It is, you know, community-based. It's about rescuing people and helping people and not, you know, killing for no reason, but killing in self-defense if that's what you need to do. Killmonger, he doesn't have the love that is required of a revolutionary. At the heart of every great revolutionary, that Che Guevara quote, is that, you know, there is great love. And so Killmonger is more a manifestation of the African proverb that, you know, if the child is abandoned by the village, the child will burn the village down to feel its warmth. He wants to punish Wakanda because Wakanda killed his father, Wakanda abandoned him, and Wakanda abandoned the rest of the Black people around the world. The reason why T'Challa is not a hero for me is that he is met with this whole plan of global Black revolution. And he's like, no, that's not what I'm going to do. You know, we got rid of Killmonger. So now what I'm going to do instead is build a community center and teach kids to code. Like, it just seems so weak. I can't imagine why he would think that that was a good idea.
That was the novelist Brooke Obi. Olufemi Taiwo grew up in Cincinnati, child of refugees from civil war in Nigeria. He did his PhD work on post-colonial thinking at UCLA. He will be teaching philosophy next at Georgetown. His family history in Africa makes him still wary of that warrior class.
I think it is an exciting movie from a cultural and a political standpoint. I never really thought that we would get a blockbuster movie that was this sophisticated about politics at all, much less African politics. And one of the things that's interesting about Black Panther is how closely its characters map onto actual historical tensions in African history, especially the history of anti-colonial activism and struggle on the continent. Hmm. So basically, Killmonger and Nakia have two different ways of thinking of what I would call Pan-Africanism. Killmonger's Pan-Africanism is mainly oppositional. Killmonger's goal is to destroy, kill, and ultimately replace the imperial colonial oppressors of Black people on the continent and throughout the world. So it's a kind of militant Pan-Africanism or militarist Pan-Africanism. Mm-hmm. Nakia, it's important to remember, is no pacifist. We meet Nakia as she's infiltrating a group seemingly styled after Boko Haram in Nigeria. Nakia's a spy. Nakia's skilled in combat. But Nakia's goals are also Pan-Africanist goals, but more about saving Black people than killing their oppressors.
Okay.
And then T'Challa, the Black Panther, is caught up in between these views. His outlook is something like Black nationalism that's trying to reconcile itself with Pan-Africanism and trying to figure out what its responsibilities are to the rest of the world.
Are we crazy to see something of Barack Obama in T'Challa?
Not at all. It's important to remember that T'Challa's society is a multi-ethnic society.
Yep.
So for T'Challa to be the ruler of a multi-tribal society requires the same kind of personality and willingness to work across difference that endears people to Obama. The movie is about what we owe to each other in the most general sense. And in a more concrete sense, it's about what Pan-Africanism or what Black people in political communities owe to each other. On one side, you have Killmonger, who thinks that Black people should unite around the idea of conflict and opposition to oppressors. And on the other side, you have Nakia, who I think is a Harriet Tubman sort of character, who is for fighting oppression, but clear-eyed about what that's for, which is not to start our own brand of oppression, but to end oppression. And then T'Challa's trying to decide where to put himself in the spectrum between those two extremes.
So you're perfectly happy to see the noble spirit of T'Challa prevail.
I prefer T'Challa to Killmonger if I had to pick one, but I don't think that's the real choice. I think the real choice from an ideological perspective is Killmonger versus Nakia. And Nakia is the person consistently advocating the politics that I think we should have.
Define it in a campaign slogan.
Constructive Pan-Africanism. So we're going to have a Pan-Africanism that does resist oppression, but doesn't fetishize the people who are oppressing now. Today's freedom fighters can be tomorrow's genocidal dictators. And if people don't believe that, they can just look at the recent history of the continent.
Femi Taiwo has written at length about the underlying politics of Black Panther for the online review of African Political Economy. Back to Harvey Young and Itasha Womack. Harvey, so many themes threaded into that movie, and so many personalities, sort of ghosts of Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and many others, and Barack Obama. Where do you start?
It's difficult to know where to begin. There's a way in which certainly the two male protagonists offer two different visions for possibilities and possible paths, right? With Killmonger being a bit more aggressive, being more revolutionary, wanting to make a stand, use weapons to assert power.
To get even in a way.
To get even, absolutely. And T'Challa being more moderate, wanting caution and a more slower pace in terms of how to engage politics. But both are fairly thinly drawn, which is why I would go for option three. And that would be give the throne to any of the women in that film because they have a level of depth and complexity that could actually work against this patriarchal structure of male empowerment.
I love the Harriet Tubman link too. Constructive Pan-Africanism is what he's talking about. You want to decode that, Itasha Womack?
Oh, constructive Pan-Africanism?
Yeah.
Well, you know, something that was fascinating to me about the film was that ultimately you're talking about a family. So while on one level we're looking at this kind of larger dynamic of kingdoms and people from coming from different sides of the ocean, on a micro level, it's a family. There was a brother who killed a brother. It's a king and his cousin.
Yep.
And so I think when you talk about constructive Pan-Africanism, there's this essence of love and family that probably should guide a lot of the building. And I think that was a really interesting evolution in this particular narrative.
Harvey, I'm finding it a very assertive, powerful, grounded Africanism, Pan-Africanism that's being asserted here. It is not the language of complaint. It is the language of doing something.
And being involved. I mean, there is that moment in the film in which the borders are closed, and the question is, do you allow the refugees in? And what is your civic responsibility to others? Will you allow yourself to be closed off? And that serves as a metaphor for the need for engagement on the African continent itself. So I think that is something that you see within the film, this need for greater involvement. But more to the point, I agree that this is really about a family story. And if you think of it that way in the context of these superhero films, how rare is it for you to see that interpersonal dynamic rather than some alien from outer space coming in and being a monster that must be destroyed.
I just marvel at the talkability of this movie. I mean, how many movies do you want to take apart as everybody here has been doing, including you?
It's so deep.
Natasha, I mean, I find it amazingly refreshing, especially after 3 years of talking about nothing but, the orange-haired president. This is so much more substantial, so much meatier.
Yes, and, you know, I have to really give a hats off to the creators of the film because they made it a layered story. And it's fascinating. You know, these are images that over the course of a century of cinema, we haven't seen on this scale. And there was such a beauty and a thoughtfulness in weaving together a narrative that is a human tale of love and family and really looking at how you can make transformations in our world.
The meaning of textiles, the meaning of hairdos, every kind, including, you know, bald-headed women, the women warriors. It's unbelievable. The color, the landscapes, the everything. Coming up, the writer-in-chief of the new comic book series, The Rise of Black Panther, writes with Haiti in his past and on his mind. This is Open Source. The unofficial dean of American comic book critics is a man named Douglas Wolk of Austin, Texas. He has made it his life's mission to read all of the Marvels. He told us this week how many there are, and he gave us the short form of the book he's writing about what all those comic books add up to.
The amazing thing about Marvel superhero comics is that this is the biggest story that has ever been told. There are a bit over 25,000 comics that make up this gigantic story, and they all fit together. They all happen in one coherent fictional universe. Anything that's happened in one can be referred to in any other. You don't have to read them all. Not even any of the people making these comics have read them all. I've read them all, but that's because I'm weird. You can really plunge in anywhere, and it is this enormous fictional space with a gigantic history to it, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of plot threads, and thousands of characters all interacting throughout its history. You don't have to know all of that history. You can enter that story at any point and see where the lines go backwards, where the lines go forwards on a grand, grand scale. 500,000 pages of story that all fit together.
For bulk and maybe for depth, I mean, this is Homer, this is Dante, this is all of Shakespeare, all of the Elizabethans, all of Russian novels.
It's the Mahabharata, it's Doris Lessing, you know. The gigantic story is about a world of marvels, a world of wonders that has impossible, majestic, glorious things that is not this world, but also is this world metaphorically, that is what this world has the potential to be, that is this world blown up and made gaudy and gorgeous and spectacular.
In this incredible transition to movies, Marvel movies, which seem to come out big time once a month, what's gained? What's lost?
For one thing, it gains an audience. There's a lot more people who go to movies than who read comics, at least these days. It's a way to see these fantastic stories, these fantastic characters brought to life in front of you on a gigantic screen. What it loses in the translation from comics is a lot of what makes comics special, which is their drawnness, their handmadeness, the fact that they come from the eye and the hand of just a few people working very closely together. In a way that doesn't try to show us the world, it tries to show us a very personal interpretation of the world. That's something that I love about comics. That's something you don't see as much in movies, but a little bit of that magic, that art, naturally carries over into any kind of translation to any other medium that they're part of.
That was Douglas Wolk, who's read them all. The myth of Black Panther lives in multimedia now, and it's inflected with multiple accents from Africa and its diaspora. As it happens, the lead writer of Black Panther comics today, Evan Narcisse, was born in Brooklyn of Haitian parents. He grew up with the legend of Toussaint Louverture, who led a slave rebellion against French colonists and finally beat Napoleon's army to liberate Haiti in 1800, the only time that ex-slaves defeated a great power for their freedom, for which Haitians have paid a terrible price. That, too, is part of what Evan Narcisse brings to his work on Black Panther.
Chris, it's very much informing the way I write Wakanda. I've said before, like, I can write Wakandans because I'm Haitian, because there is always been a thread of thought in my mind about what it means to resist imperialism and colonialism. Part of the reality of being a Haitian American in 2018 is knowing that I come from a country that is poor and under-resourced by direct consequence of ousting its colonizers. Haiti was made to pay reparations to France for the lost income it would have gotten from slavery.
And it went on into the middle of the 20th century, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it did. And when I think about, when I apply that to the fiction that I'm writing, Wakanda is a place that never had to pay that cost. It never had to pay the initial cost of slavery and exploitation, and it never had to pay the double damned cost of reparations to the colonizers.
What is it like to hold that fantasy of Wakanda, ironically, in the same mind that knows the truth of an unjust world, and especially Haiti, to this very day?
It's surreal and dissonant and emotional, you know? Like, I've had to navigate my own sense of Haitian-American identity by virtue of distance, you know? Like, my Creole is not as good as my mom's was. I can't cook the way that she did. But I'm still proud of what Haiti means and has meant in this country, rather in this world's history. So it's a little bit bittersweet when I have to think of a fantasy that embodies all that Haiti could have been without imperialism. It is bittersweet to imagine a fiction of a country that never suffered those slights while also living in a country where those slights have made a certain kind of injustice prevalent for people who look like me.
Can you sort of share the creation of the new Black Panther as you're managing it, starting from this marvelous character T'Challa having to fight for the throne of his father, what that is all about?
So T'Challa's the Black Panther character that we all know. He's the superhero who joins the Avengers. My series deals with his first year as king, and it's very much present in T'Challa's mind that for me, he's got a whole legacy to uphold. This is his family bloodline, his country's history. So when he fights to become king, he's fighting for the ideals that have kept Wakanda uncolonized for decades. Those ideals are self-determination, are black agency and black glory, of living in defiance of the kind of exploitation that ruined the rest of the continent of Africa.
And his father.
And his father, yes. You know, colonialization and imperialism took T'Challa's dad from him. It's very Shakespearean, you know. It's a man working against the world.
Evan, I'm reminded of mythic characters. Odysseus comes to mind. Ulysses, who can get repurposed in many different centuries and ways. What are you trying to do with this role that you've inherited and now are pointing forward in the 21st century?
I mean, one of the reasons T'Challa was always important to me as a reader growing up was he was a black character who felt like he lived on his own terms from a country where they lived on their own terms for centuries. And part of the thematics powering my approach to T'Challa now are the ideas of black self-agency and how important that is to people in the 21st century. You know, I come from a Haitian background. My parents immigrated to the United States in the late 60s, early 70s. I was born in the United States. I'm very proud to be a Haitian, but I'm also living in a period of time when the president of the United States calls my homeland a shithole. And I'm writing comics from a perspective that black communities, black countries are not shitholes. They have glorious history and culture that deserve to be celebrated. Granted, Wakanda is a fictional construct, but it's a fictional construct filled with the black cultural energy of decades of self-reliance and self-love and survival.
Point us forward. T'Challa regains his throne in the movie. Where is he going from here? What's the test?
Well, I'm writing a 6-issue miniseries that has a clear end goal, and that's, you know, kind of rapprochement with the outside world. It's about Wakanda learning to coexist with the world. They've have a history of distrusting and a justified history of distrusting. T'Challa's role as a superhero is to show his Wakandan people that we can bring the best of our society, our technology, and our culture and use it to better the world. And it's also to show the outside world, here's what Black ingenuity and genius can look like. And the communities that you've raped and pillaged over the centuries could have had all of this and more.
That was the Black Panther writer, Evan Narcisse. Itasha Womack, I'm just fascinated by the complexity of these voices. We've heard people educated thinking from U.S. Air Force bases, from Nigeria, from Haiti. This, to me, is the Pan-African mind at work. And if I dare say, it makes white American perspectives on the world feel rather provincial.
Well, you know, I think that it's really exciting that we see these perspectives on this scale, because it acknowledges that these perspectives exist and have been around for some time. One of the things that surprises me sometimes when people make generalizations about Black communities, they feel like Black communities around the world are this monolith. And there doesn't seem to be an awareness of the complexity or the layer of nuances around thoughts about liberation, identity, and humanity.
But they do connect, right?
Oh, absolutely. It totally connects. And I think you see that. I mean, these voices that you're hearing talking about these issues are voices that are really working with the same themes and concepts. And one of the exciting things about working in Afrofuturism or researching it was to see that as I spoke to people around the world, they had similar ideas around time and femininity and the future that were very rooted in an Africanness that they just automatically connected to. And I just thought that was compelling.
Same time, I want to, maybe this is for you, Harvey, I want to put in a word for the American imagination. The inventor, wild man, Sebastian Thrun, who was working on the, you know, driverless car years ago for Google, but a German, you know, wild futurist, said to us a few years ago, but he said, if you've got an insurmountable problem, how are you going to solve it? Send it to Hollywood. That's where the American imagination lives and thrives and gets answers. I have a feeling watching this movie. But where else would we get such a complex, fair-minded, deep, future-minded resolution of so many things that we can't seem to move in this country?
To go back to the Haiti example, there is a darkness to the film that I had not fully appreciated, but this conversation has been absolutely wonderful because there's a sense of isolation that exists in both Killmonger's life and T'Challa's life where they're both kept apart. And if anything, this is a story about how you have to resist that tendency of isolation, even if isolation is what allows you to maintain your separation and independence and prosperity, because it's your duty to help the other person. And that's the lasting lesson for me, that you have to put those barriers down, open the door, reach a hand out to the person who is suffering and struggling and help them along the way, help them realize their possibility.
There's another dimension of this thing I just want to mention. And that is going back to Isabel Wilkerson's unforgettable book on the great migration of Black people out of Jim Crow, The Warmth of Other Suns. That was about a migration between in the first 50 years roughly of the 20th century. And it remade, looking back, it's so obvious, it just remade American culture. Jazz, hip-hop, literature, the Ralph Ellisons of the world, but also sports, and it's with us more than ever. This movie makes me feel that a second surge is on the way, and it's ready, and it's all over the place.
There's a generation of people who are now inspired by this film who now have it as a cultural touchstone, something to talk about, to share, to be inspired by, to create new comic strips and comic books and music and film and theater, and that's extraordinary.
Itasha, what other worlds lie ahead for discovery?
Well, I think that this is an exciting way to see how our human experiences overlap. On one level, the Black Panther story was a story that talked a lot about dynamics in the African diaspora. But at the heart of it, it is a human story that we can relate to. People can relate to from so many different walks of life. And it makes a statement about something else that Afrofuturism acknowledges, which is this idea that race was created. Race is very much an invention. It was created to justify the transatlantic slave trade and enforced through law and violence. And I think although we've chipped away at that concept and those constructs, a movie like this is a reminder of our innate humanity.
Part of the revelation for me is what John Jennings identified as the Black speculative arts tradition. We know there's a religious tradition, musical tradition, all kinds of traditions, but the idea of speculative philosophical invention is kind of news for me.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When we talk about Black cultures, it's often discussed in such a dystopian way. But the reality is that the imagination and the ability to think about a future and work towards one was very much a tool of resilience that saved lives. It kept people moving forward. The artistic and cultural production of these cultures at various points in time was about survival, creating alternate realities to immerse yourself in, to become empowered, and then come out into the world and live a life of dignity and make a difference, even when your humanity was being questioned. And I think that is, it's beautiful to remember that.
Harvey, I wonder, isn't it remarkable that there's also a very confident middle-class professional air about so many people involved in this movie?
There is, and it really reminds us that oftentimes we don't acknowledge the complexity and the diversity of Blackness in the world. And
the success of Blackness,
well,
too.
The success, but it's also that there are many ways of being Black in the world, and all of them come together and are part of the making of this film and in many ways inspired by this film. So you can find a sense of optimism and possibility here.
It's also a mystery maybe for another conversation, but who knew that the appetite in the broad public was as powerfully hungry for this sort of change in our conversation?
Well, I quickly say that
$700-800 million. Warren Beatty's last movie, I think, netted $700,000. This is a big culture change.
Well, Black films make money, and Monica White Nadunu, who's a professor at Dartmouth, has written about this, that regardless of the text you look at, Black films make money. And the issue is that Hollywood hasn't invested at a large scale. And the more you invest in, the more you can make, because there's a eager, hungry audience who want to see themselves on the screen.
Who knew that all those people were reading comic books all this time? We're looking at John Jennings' big, beautiful, multicolor book on Black comics return. And lines that go around the corner of the Schomburg Center in Manhattan on the weekend of the MLK Day. Just, you know, plumbers, waitresses, you know, all sorts of people who do cartoons in their spare time.
It's inspiring to see yourself.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the whole message. Last word, Itasha.
Well, Black Panther is very much a response to a phenomenon that has been taking place for a number of years, and that is people creating sci-fi images of themselves in the future through literature, through comics, and doing so oftentimes on an indie level. And there's been a demand to see more of these works. And through social media, I think people were able to gauge that and say, okay, we can make a story about Black Panther now.
Up with all of it. I feel a new era opening. Thank you, Itasha Womack, Harvey Young, Douglas Wolk, Brooke Obi, Femi Taiwo, and John Jennings. Thanks also to Stephanie Burt and Kenya Robinson. Our show is produced by the Fantastic Four, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DeGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our superhero engineer. Mary McGrath is our Wonder Woman. I'm just Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.